here and welcome to the GVA Legal Podcast. My name is Jean Kambuni and I am your host. 4th January, that was yesterday, was World Braille Day. World Braille Day is celebrated every year to recognize the efforts of Louis Braille. And today, we'd like to educate ourselves on the plight of the blind and partially sighted people in Kenya. In studio with me are two people. We have Susan Nafula, the Chief Legal Officer at the National Council for Persons with Disabilities, and her colleague, Brilliant Jockey. Welcome, Susan and Brilliant.
Thank you very much for inviting us. And let's continue with educating the public in regards to disability in the world.
Welcome, Brilliant.
Thank you as well for having us.
So let's go right into the topic. And I'd like us to start with the basics. What is disability and who are persons with disabilities?
Basically, when you hear the word disability, you think about vulnerability and marginalized. So disability in its legal sense or in interpretation of law and any other statutes means physical, sensory, mental, and any other impairment, including visual, hearing, learning, or physical incapabilities of doing anything in regards to normalcy in your work or in your day-to-day life. So persons with disability are the people who have disability per se. They are, we cannot say inequipped, but they do not have one sensory or the other in regards to the blind, the deaf, and also the other ones with mental disability. And also there's their developmental disability per se. So in the context of Kenya, there are various avenues of defining disability. We have our Persons with Disability Act for 2003. Then we have the Convention for Persons with Disability. And then we have also the Constitution, which have recognized the plight and the rights of persons with disability. So those are the various laws or guidelines in regards to disability.
So let me just break down that down for our listeners. You've said there are multiple categories of persons with disabilities. So you can have physical disabilities. So this is whether you are unable to walk, you're unable to see, you're unable to hear. Those are disabilities that are related to your physical person. You can also have what you called mental or developmental disabilities. So this could be people with perhaps they're on the autism spectrum, or they have palsy or any other type of disability that targets their mental capacities. But you also have learning disabilities, so persons who are maybe dyslexic or have any other disability that hinders or limits or makes the learning process more difficult for them. So the spectrum of disabilities goes everywhere from physical to mental to intellectual to even sensory. Now, let me go to my next question. What is the impact of disability? And we've spoken about this different spectrum of disabilities or the range that you can be on. What impact does it have on your education or your work and employability or your income?
For education, there's the aspect of accessibility to the learning institutions. Some of the institutions are not disability friendly. Like, for example, if somebody has physical disability, they will not be able to go to classes in the third floor if you don't have a lift, or they don't have a ramp even to access the first floor of the classes. So you find there's that challenge of actually accessing the education institution. Then you go in regards to the work. Some of the persons with disability, because of either financial or their background or their family dynamics, they're not able to get desk jobs per se or white collar jobs. So they tend to go to do the tertiary kind of education under TVET. And then you find some of the employers are not confident with their abilities, and yet they can do, especially somebody who is physically disabled, they can do work with their hands. They can actually deliver just like somebody else who can really walk or do any other work that is required. So you find even persons with a mental disability, they do not disclose it. For somebody with autism, some of them are really smart. They just need to be guided, or they take their medication, then do all those practices, that the therapy that they require. But they're really smart people. So you find most of them, when they apply for jobs, they do not disclose it because they're afraid of discrimination. So maybe down the line, maybe after a few years, that's when it develops or it comes out that they had a mental disability or per se. Then in regards to income, under the Persons with Disability Act of 2003, the income of persons with disability are exempted from tax. So you find some institutions or some persons with disability who have the tax exemptions, their incomes are not waived from the tax of the pay as you earn. So you find some of the employers are resisting in that aspect of relieving them. The reason why the tax exemption exists is to relieve them from the pressure of paying and also ensure that their income is sustainable for them and their families per se. So there's that issue there. As for livelihood, you'll find it's going to be very difficult, especially for somebody who is blind, to actually own a shop because he'll be dependent on somebody else to actually run the shop and the person might be stealing from them. So you find they start a business or they continue with a business, but it's making more losses than profit. And you wonder what is the issue. But now people take advantage in that regards. So livelihood also, it's limited depending on what kind of disability you have and the dependency that you have in regards to the other person to take care of your basic needs or any other thing.
So there's something that you've brought out. You brought about, and I want to discuss those three things. So one of the things you talked about was stigma. So this is the perceptions that employers or even fellow workers have towards a person with disability. Depending on the severity of the disability that they have, that can impact the ability of that person to, one, be employed, and two, to keep the job. So whereas someone might employ them, even just to meet a quota, once that person is within the within employment, they experience a level of discrimination that is either overt or covert, and that then impacts the ability to stay in that job. A second thing you've brought out is the vulnerability of persons with disability. So depending on how dependent, the word you used was dependency, on another person for assistance. So if, for instance, the example you gave of a blind person who needs a sighted person to be able to at least facilitate the interaction with customers and ensure that they receive the right amount of money, then their dependency and the level of trust between those two people impacts the livelihoods of that person with disability. So the more dependent a person with disability is, the higher the trust required between them and their caregiver or their partner or their assistant. And then that also impacts the livelihood that that person has, the quality of life, and the just generally how, if they're able to acquire an income. Then another thing that you spoke about was perceptions of disability. So sometimes, and you spoke about this with regard to persons who are autistic, I may perceive this person to be very disabled. However, their disability is absolutely no measure of their intelligence and their ability to conduct the task. So we need some sort of education to be able to understand that sometimes I may have a disability that hinders my functioning in certain areas, but that has no impact on my ability to work. Now, let me bring you to your employer, the National Council for Persons with Disabilities. Who is the National Council for Persons with Disabilities and what is your mandate?
The National Council for Persons with Disability is a state corporation, a state body, which is established under Section 3 of the Persons with Disability Act of 2003. And we have several mandates and functions. The first one is registration of persons with disability. The other one is the issuing of adjustment orders, which are mainly to both public and private institutions for them to make adjustments in regards to making their building or their facility accessible to persons with disability. Then we have the issuance of assistive devices like the hearing aid, the white canes, and also wheelchairs. And then we have the disability mainstreaming. For disability mainstreaming, we actually assist in policy where we advocate for disability mainstreaming in institutions to enable them to be all inclusive in either employment or whatever service that they give. It should be diverse and all inclusive for persons with disability. Then there's the formulation of policies and measures regarding persons with disability. Currently, we have amended the Persons with Disability Act, which now is in the Senate waiting for debate. It had already passed in the National Assembly because it went to the Senate because it has an element of counties. So now we are still waiting on that because now you can see that our Persons with Disability Act of 2003 is not aligned with the Constitution, and also it does not align with the Convention of Persons with Disability. So now we sat down and discussed, because now it's not per se redundant, but it's not complying with the Constitution, which is the supreme law. And then now we have coordination with national and county governments to ensure protection of persons with disability. We have been engaging with counties for them to actually enact laws in regards to persons with disability, because you'll find a person in Mandera, his needs are different from a person maybe in Machakos or in Nairobi. So the counties, if they do needs-based assessment and see what exactly and who their number of persons with disability are in their county and what exactly they need, because the needs are totally different, the accessibility is totally different, and also the aspect of the rights are also different in regards to that county. And then in ensuring that incentives and waivers are granted to persons with disability and caregivers and donors. So incentives are for employers who employ persons with disability. They get a sort of a tax reduction in their submission of their returns, because now we are encouraging that this is a way of encouraging them to hire more persons with disability in their workforce. And then the waivers, normally we try to negotiate maybe with counties to give business permit waivers so for persons with disability, so that they can be able to be economically empowered and be able to sustain their livelihoods per se. And then there's also the waiver of motor vehicles. We try to negotiate importation tax for vehicles, specifically for persons with disability, in regards to assist them in moving around, mobility per se. So now we have tried, and also for the caregivers, we have the aspect of cash transfer, because you find that people who have severe disability totally dependent on another person to actually do the basic things like accessing the toilet or being rolling over in bed to go to there to sleep on the other side, or moving from the sitting room to go outside and at least bask in the sun. So we have that cash transfer in regards where the caregiver, because they'll be 24 hours taking care of this person, they need some income to actually take care of them. So there's that caregiver allowance which is given to the caregivers for that per se. And then for donors, if they assist somewhat, we have an arrangement in regards to the areas that they can assist us. We are very specific on those, so as to help us achieve our mandate.
And what achievements has the National Council for Persons with Disabilities had in doing engaging its work and achieving its mandate?
So the recent one is that we were given an award in regards to most diverse and inclusive parastatal of the year in the annual Human Resource Award, where 40% of our staff are persons with disability. So that was one of the achievements that we have in regards to employment of persons with disability. Then again, we have also developed a new registration system whereby we are trying to weed out the people who are fraudsters and who are pretending to be persons with disability to gain the privileges and the rights that are the privileges that are being given to persons with disability, so that we can make our system more authentic in that regards, so that we get the correct number of persons with disability. This number, we can submit it to the government and say, these are the people who are persons with disability in the country. Kindly allocate this much for funds to assist us in be able to do our mandate. So we are trying to get the statistics right, because without statistics, there's the aspects of budgeting, the aspect of prioritization. The other thing that we have done, we have decentralized the signature of the Director of Medical Services, which is required for persons with disability who go for disability assessment. So now it has gone to the counties. It has been devolved. Now it is very easy, because previously persons with disability had to go all the way from a county, let's say like from Mandera, bring your forms all the way to Nairobi at Afya House so that it can be signed. So now we have, through our efforts and also the Council of Governors and partners and other stakeholders, we have been able to decentralize it to make it easier. Then, as I said previously, for cash transfer, we have tried to get as more people registered into the system and into the payroll, so as to be able to assist persons with severe disability. Then there's the aspect of AGPO, the procurement of persons with disability to actually participate in the tendering activity and process. So now, as for the council, we tend to advocate for persons with disability to actually bid for the tenders. So we try our best to encourage them to apply, and we also do sensitization processes and other forums so that they can be able to know the opportunities that they're there. Then the last thing is the legal aid clinic. We came to realize that most of the persons with disability only base their rights on three laws. That's the Persons with Disability Act for 203, the Convention of Persons with Disability, and also the Constitution. But there are various other legislations, regulations out there which they can use to actually protect themselves from discrimination and also know their rights in whatever particular circumstance they find themselves in.
Now, you've spoken answering that question, you've given us a couple of the challenges a person with disability face. You've spoken about discrimination, you've spoken about lack of access to services, lack of access to even opportunities. And that's why you're working with them to sensitize them on the opportunities that are available to them. What are the challenges, generally, the main challenges that persons with disabilities face?
The first thing is knowing their rights and knowing that they can actually actualize their rights in various avenues which they're given. But now, if you don't know your rights per se, then you will not be able to fight for your right. So the first thing is the lack of knowledge of what your right is, where to get that right, and how to get that right. So now, if we advocate for knowledge in regards to knowing your rights in that particular area, then I think some of the challenges can be addressed. Then there's also the aspect of abuse. Some of the persons with disability are taken advantage of in one way or the other. And then now you find also the aspect of, for example, like being stigmatized in the sense that any wrong thing that happens in a particular place, it's that person. There's nobody else, no suspect, no nothing. They're the ones who have done it. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the aspect of education, basic education. If you look at our schools, some of them, like the CBC, it is not disability friendly in regards to teaching the students on what exactly, how they can be able to progress in life. It was just the element of disability or educating a child with disability was not considered when developing the curriculum. So there's that one. And there's also the aspect of participation in the building of the nation. You find some of them are intelligent. They can work with their hands. Some can do various things, but they're not involved in those particular programs that are being either for the government or in the local level or the community level. They are excluded. They say, that one, just leave them alone. There's nothing they can help. So the challenges are many, and it depends on the circumstance that you're in, like I said, and also the family dynamics, the culture, and also the level of education or awareness or exposure.
Does income make any difference? Like, for instance, if a person with disabilities came from a higher income household in which the parents were more educated, does that then change or impact their outcomes?
Yeah, definitely does, because like they say, money makes the world go round, and accessibility and opportunity opens doors only through money or financial stability. So you'll find that if a parent is educated, they will know, surpass the element of disability and look at their child's capability. So they will not focus their child's disability as the main call. They'll focus on their ability. What can my child do? Or what can my child achieve if only I do A, B, C, D? So you'll find most of the people who are well off, some of the children even don't study in Kenya. They go either abroad, because at least abroad they have, it's called diversified in regards to inclusivity in education, in health and all that. So you'll find that they'll take them there. So financial stability and an educated parent will be able to change the life of a person with disability. But also, some parents are not educated, but they can see the potential of their children. So now they struggle so much to actually educate their children because they know education is the only way my child can be able to compete equally in this spectrum of who the animal eats, animal, person eat, person world. So now you'll find them, they'll focus on education, they'll give their time on education, but also the education system tends to fail them because now the schools or the institutions they can afford is not well equipped. So the child will just get the basic or the bare minimum, unlike the person who's being taken to a school where everything is possible.
Now, because you've mentioned it, I want to ask this here rather than at the end when I wanted to ask what we could do better. You mentioned that the competence-based curriculum that we are currently implementing had a drawback in that it did not really consider the plight of children with disabilities and their specific and unique learning needs. Now that there is a task force that is reviewing it, what could that task force do? What could have been done different about CBC that could have been more inclusive for children with disability?
Basically, the task force needs to do an assessment in regards to the curriculum and its accessibility. Because now, if you see the books, some of them are not in Braille. So a blind child will not be able to read the books, or they'll be forced to do either audio or just listen in class and just be able to float through the whole class during the teaching. And then also the teachers themselves, they are not educated enough or exposed or given the skills or capacity to be able to deal with children with especially intellectual disability, and also how to manage them, because they require guidance in specific areas, and they tend to not be slow, but they need that special attention from the teachers. So the teachers also are lacking in regards to how to identify a child with intellectual disability. But now for the task force, I think they need to know how to integrate everyone. We are trying to find an inclusion in schools. So I would think, or I would prefer, if the schools themselves, as they are doing the CBC and being inclusive, they should not assume that all children are of the same levels. Children are of different levels. So children with disability, they have to be categorized in different levels, and they have to be given their special needs in regards to this to the curriculum. So they should focus on how the curriculum can be able to be used by a child with intellectual disability, and also for a child who doesn't have. So the integration of this curriculum has to be all inclusive. If my child, hypothetically, has an intellectual disability, when they are being taught, they should be able to understand whatever is being taught the same way as the other child, so that they can be on the same level, on equal playing field. But now for the CBC, I think it's kind of a disadvantage for children with disability per se, especially the ones with intellectual disability.
Now, you brought us into one of the things that I think CBC should think of, and that is getting all of the teaching material and learning material to be accessible and understandable to all persons. And one of the ways is through translating it into Braille. And that brings us to what I said. The 4th of January was World Braille Day. And I want you to tell us, Brilliant, what is the importance of World Braille Day and why do we celebrate it?
Okay. So World Braille Day is a day that recognizes the inventor, basically Louis Braille. So what happened is Louis Braille was the man after the invention of the Braille. And at the age of 3, Louis lost his left eye, which actually spread through to the right eye. And he could not, just like any other child, could not do things in a normal way. So he spent most of his time at the Royal Institute of the Blind in France. And during his time, at the age of 3, he was able to come up with a system which he invented and also perfected, that he included dots that he could actually fill and actually come up with alphabets, and also come up with maybe patterns that would allow him to actually know what is actually being talked about when it comes to actually learning like any other person in the institute. So this day marks it actually gives like a form of inclusivity for people who are blind and also visually impaired, and also people who are print disabled. What do I mean when I say some sort of inclusivity? So the day actually tries to bring out the aspect that people who are blind and also visually impaired have the same human rights or deserve at least the same level of awareness when it comes to their own human rights, in that, for example, they don't need to keep relying on people to actually help them read through documents. Basically that they don't need to rely on people to read documents to them. For example, some of the documents are very sensitive. As we all know, data protection comes in there. So bank statements or information about their medical progress, just documents that you wouldn't allow any other person except like caregivers or close family, friends to actually access. That day actually recognizes persons who are visually disabled. And also to make it easy, the day also tries to mark the Marrakesh Treaty. There's a treaty that was actually assented to, I think in 2013, the treaty actually makes it able for people who are blind and also visually impaired to actually interpret it, either individuals or organizations who take care of people who are blind and visually impaired, to actually come up with a version of the original that is already printed out. So in Article 4 to 6 of the Marrakesh Treaty, it makes it easier for them in that there are exceptions that have been made to them. They can actually have a copy of it without actually infringing on the copyright. Yes.
So it gives partially sighted and blind persons ability to be able to access any form of information in Braille without it infringing on any copyright laws.
Yes.
You had told me, you had intimated that Braille has a system of dots that then were translated into their own alphabet. And through that way, a partially sighted or a blind person can be able to read and understand different things. Mm-hmm. How exactly does it work?
Okay. So Braille is not its own language. It has been interpreted into very many other languages. So it started with like 6 dots. Mm-hmm. And in those 6 dots, what happens is Braille in math is not the same as Braille in music and all that. So the patterns are different. We have up to 64 dots as at right now. Unfortunately, by the time Braille died, he was not able to live to see what this invention is actually going to become. So by the time the Royal Institute for the Blind in France started teaching Braille, he was not around. And with time, they have actually revised it and invented very many versions of it. So with the 64 dots, they can be able to play around them and also jug around them so that they can come up with patterns which can actually bring out the pattern of a music and also the pattern of alphabets, numbers. And as they feel them with their fingertips, they're able to tell what are we basically speaking about. And that's why, as my colleague talked about inclusivity, when it comes to the curriculum in our schools, it will be very thoughtful of the task force to actually think about it, so that as we have books which are in math and we have books which are in English, so the same way Braille should also be, by the use of those dots, they are able to actually feel and know that actually we are doing math today, and this is what the teacher is actually speaking about today's language, music.
Now, Susan, I'd like to bring you back and ask a question. So do all people who are blind or partially sighted know Braille? Is it like ubiquitous?
No, it's not. Especially from my experience, people who have acquired their disability as being blind find it a challenge to actually learn how to read Braille. But people who are born blind are the ones who are equipped, because they are being taught from a tender age of how to read and interpret and communicate through Braille. But people who acquire blindness either in their early ages or their teens, they find it difficult to actually master the aspect of Braille. So you find it's going to be very difficult for somebody who maybe has lived until seeing everything until the age of maybe 20. They lose their sight. They find it difficult to navigate the aspect of Braille, because now it's like French. For example, it's like you're learning a new language or a new way of communicating. So some of them find it difficult to actually do that. So they go to the way of either audiobooks or having guides interpret for them or read for them so that they can be able to understand whatever is on the context of the paper, or even communicating, they can translate it through the audio in the installation of those softwares that are there, so they can be able to communicate or read or understand any aspect that is given to them. So Braille is kind of a new language for somebody who has never interacted with it at a younger age, so that you find it's they do not want to go the added expenses of learning Braille, so they embrace technology per se.
And for persons who are born blind, how easy is it for them to access teachers and facilities where they can be able to learn Braille? Is it how easy, for instance, if I were to have a child who was blind and I need they get to school going age, how easy would it be for me to find a teacher who can teach Braille?
For that, I think it's the child has to go to special schools, like for Thika School for the Blind. They tend to teach in Braille, but also it's also coming up to be a dying art per se. Not many. You'll find like the teachers who are there, they're the old ones, the ones who started from the beginning of time. That now no new recruits of teachers actually know how to teach in Braille. It's not part of the curriculum per se in the teaching schools, in the teaching colleges. They're not being taught that aspect of how to teach a child of Braille or anything. So now you find that the skill is dying slowly. Then you find the people who are actually there who have mastered the art. Either two things: they are overworked, or they have not been given the ability to actually mentor other people. So you find parents are the ones who are going to go and learn so that they can be able to assist their children in school. So now that's where also the CBC comes in. If my child is blind and I have not been taught how to do Braille, how will I be able to assist my child with homework? And I don't know anything about Braille. I have never interacted with such a thing. And then now my child is expected to compete with other children who actually can read and can see the books. So the aspect of Braille and the skill and the know-how and also the continuous education and skill transference is really limited per se.
So you've brought about something and you talked about the increased reliance on technology. Will that lead to the elimination of, will it replace Braille, or is Braille still a very important part of the communication ability of blind and partially sighted persons?
Unfortunately, we are all going technology side, and also like we have seen so far, hard copy books, people don't read them anymore. Everything is online, everything is on the access of your phone. So as time goes by, I think the Braille will either slowly die or become not extinct per se, but will be just like put in a shelf of special section, like in the libraries, how they have special section or encyclopedia or a compendium that side, because now people have gone to the aspect of technology, audiobooks, read fast paced books or all that. So even if you see in the phones, people are in their phones, they have this new, every day we find new apps, every day we find new software, every day. So by the time maybe like 20 years down the line, Braille will be extinct, will be a section in the library.
Oh, that, I feel like that's a bit sad, because though I understand why it would be important for you to have audiobooks and how that still makes education accessible to blind and partially sighted people, I still find it difficult to see, like, for instance, one of the places where I interact with Braille on a daily basis is in the elevator. In the elevator, I always see that even as I press whatever floor that I'm going to, right next to it is, I can feel out the dots that signify the floor number for a partially sighted or blind person. I don't know how we will be able to mitigate that in future if at all maybe we don't have them walking with headphones continually, informing them that there's an elevator coming up, the first floor, second floor. And some elevators do speak it out, but I think that there may be some places where Braille might still be very, very relevant, even just in filling out hard copy documents. My final question, in your view, both you, Brilliant, and Susan, I think I'll begin with you, Brilliant, what remains to be done to improve the plight of persons with disabilities? What can we do better?
Okay. So basically, it is more awareness needs to be spread through for persons with a disability, and also specifically for the blind and also the visually impaired. So they need to be more educated on their rights, basically, and also more educated on what they need to do in case of maybe they encounter discrimination around their workplaces. So more sensitization needs to be given to persons with disability. And also, personally, I think it is a unique way and also a very smart way of using Braille. And it should not come to an end, basically. So maybe find a way to improve it. And also, yeah, maybe you can integrate it to the technology how in a unique way.
Susan, what do you think needs to be done to improve the plight of persons with disabilities?
So as for me, personally, I think educate. Because if you don't educate someone, you will not be able to change their perception of things. Because everybody has a perception of things. If I see black, you may see gray. But now, we cannot agree on that if you do not educate me on why you're seeing black and why I'm seeing gray. So the aspect of interaction and educating each other is the best place to know where exactly a person can be able to assist or be able to be improved in life. So for persons with disability, I think we need to be able to interact with them on a personal level, not seeing the disability, but seeing their ability to do things or think, or how do they think? How do will they be able to handle something in a way that I will not be able to handle? So if we be able to educate each other on our perceptions or educate each other on our point of view, I think we can be able to integrate really well, cooperate very well, and also be inclusive and mindful of each other on a level of being a human being and not on a level of differentiation. So that's my opinion in regards to improving.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank my guests, Susan Nafula and Brilliant Jockey from the National Council for Persons with Disabilities. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for your amazing insights. And I am your host, Jean Kambuni. I'd like to end with a quote from Louis Braille, the inventor of Braille. Access to communication in the widest sense is access to knowledge. And that is vitally important for us. If we, the blind, are not to go on being despised or patronized by condescending sighted people, we do not need pity. We do not need to be reminded that we are vulnerable. We must be treated as equals. And communication is the way that can be brought about. I guess that was his inspiration for coming up with Braille. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and tell us what you think about it in the comment section of our social media pages. You can find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as GVA Law Firm. Thank you again for joining us on the GVA Legal Podcast. Let's get free.